From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A historic Quaker cemetery where Lucretia Mott and other abolitionists and reformers are buried is in the center of a neighborhood now known for its drug dealing and violence. In the 80s, the cemetery was turned into a virtual junkyard and a haven for drug dealers. Then the Quakers decided to reclaim it and clean it up with the help of the community. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from the Quaker heading up the effort and from a middle school teacher, one of his students, and a community activist who have become involved. Also, Milo Miles on Cubanismo, a band of Cuban residents and expatriates. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Supreme Court has narrowly approved a Georgia congressional redistricting map. The map features only one black majority voting district. The vote was 5-4. The decision ends remapping efforts that followed the 1990 census. At the time, the Justice Department asked the Georgia legislature to come up with a plan for three majority black voting districts. Lawsuits against the requirement followed, and a three-judge panel finally devised the current map, upheld by the Supreme Court. Jurors are set to begin deliberating the fate of the man who raped and murdered New Jersey girl Megan Kanka. Jurors must decide whether Jesse Temendequas will receive life in prison without parole or the death penalty. NPR's Melissa Block reports from Trenton.
The prosecution spent an hour and a half presenting its closing arguments this morning, asking the jury to sentence Temendequas to death. Prosecutor Catherine Flicker said the defendant in killing Megan showed no pity, no compassion, no mercy. He deserved none for what he chose to do. She also tried to cast doubt on the mitigating factors that were presented by the defense, especially claims that Temendequas was severely abused as a child by his father. The defense claims Temendequas suffers from extreme mental illness and is remorseful for his crime and has asked the jury to show compassion. The jurors must weigh the dozens of mitigating factors introduced against the aggravating factors presented by the state. The jurors must be unanimous if they vote for a death sentence. Anything but a unanimous vote means that Temendequas will be sentenced to life in prison without parole. At the Mercer County Courthouse in Trenton, I'm Melissa Block.
President Clinton is traveling to Denver today to attend the Summit of Eight, formerly the Group of Seven Industrial Nations, which now includes Russia. The summit formally opens tomorrow night with a reception at the home of Colorado Governor Roy Romer. Mr. Clinton will deliver a pre-summit speech today in Denver at the National Digital Television Center. Cambodia is now denying reports that former Khmer Rouge leader Pol Pot has surrendered. It's not clear where Pol Pot is now. Some reports say he's hiding in Cambodia's northern jungle, trying to escape the rebels he used to command. Scott Anger reports from Phnom Penh.
Cambodia's first prime minister, Prince Norodom Ranariddh, said today that Pol Pot is still surrounded by Khmer Rouge defectors but is not in custody. He denied a statement reportedly made by his top general yesterday that the former dictator had surrendered near the Thai border. The general also reversed his story today, saying that Pol Pot remained on the loose. Co-Prime Minister Hun Sen has accused the prince of illegally courting some senior Khmer Rouge leaders, adding tension to the already polarized government. This tension erupted into street fighting Tuesday, leaving two dead. Government officials would not speculate today on when Pol Pot would surrender or be taken by force. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Anger in Phnom Penh.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 30 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher in active trading. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The market's rise is being led by consumer stocks. Tobacco issues are benefiting from reports that a tentative agreement has been reached in lawsuits against the cigarette industry. And drug shares are higher after Pfizer was reiterated Focus One stock at Cowen and Company. On the other hand, both AT&T and SBC Communications have fallen after the chairman of the FCC said that a possible merger of the two is unthinkable. And computer software issues have declined after Adobe Systems reported disappointing sales and earnings. Adobe is most active in the NASDAQ market. Its shares are down 14%. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government reports the nation's trade deficit ballooned 7.8% in April. The Commerce Department says the imbalance in goods and services was $8.4 billion. American consumers bought a lot of imported clothing, toys, and pharmaceutical products. The deficit with Japan was larger than with any other nation. A British judge has found that two vegetarian activists libeled McDonald's Corporation. Justice Roger Bell says a pamphlet the pair handed out defames the hamburger chain, even though some of the statements in the pamphlet are true. Bell says some of the allegations against McDonald's that are probably true include low wages for workers, some cruel treatment of animals, and exploitation of children through advertising. Bell awarded McDonald's more than $90,000 in damages, but analysts estimate McDonald's spent more than $15 million on the suit. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's up more than 30 points at 7,749. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the middle of a North Philadelphia neighborhood that's become famous for drug trafficking and drive-bys is a Quaker cemetery known as the Fairhill Burial Ground. There lie Lucretia Mott, the abolitionist and feminist, Robert Purvis, who was known as the president of the Underground Railroad, and other abolitionists and 19th-century reformers. In 1985, long after the Quakers had moved out of the neighborhood, they sold the burial ground and meeting house to a Baptist church. The change coincided with the rise of crack. The burial ground was trashed and vandalized and became a haven for drug users and dealers. Neighbors complained, and in response, the Quakers formed a group to buy back and, with the help of the community, clean up the cemetery. My guest, Marianne Hunter, is the president of the Fairhill Burial Ground Corporation, which is leading the restoration effort. I asked her when the Quakers decided to take back the burial ground.
Well, probably 5 or 6 years ago, the state of the burial ground was very distressing to Margaret Bacon, the biographer of Lucretia Mott, a local Quaker. And she began to talk to any and all who were interested and stirred up a group of us to see what we could do. So there was a kind of predecessor project where one of our members spent a year or more in the neighborhood trying to understand what the organizational capacities were, what the interests, what the concerns were, and how we might re-enter that picture in a constructive way. And then during that time, we began the process of negotiation to see if we might buy the burial ground back, because it seemed like, in the end, that was going to be the practical way to address the problem.
What was the ambition when the Quakers decided to buy it back?
Just to restore the property to some useful function in the neighborhood. I think some people had visions of it being a very active center or spot for recreation. Others just saw it as a historical burial ground, and other people wanted kids to be able to visit Lucretia Mott's grave. So we've been kind of feeling our way to see what of that is achievable and what makes sense and what fits with what the neighborhood wants to do.
Tell me about your first trip to the burial ground. When was it? What state was it in?
Oh, it was a kind of late fall Sunday, and my husband and I drove up after meeting. And it was both wonderful and distressing. It was a very peaceful, bright, sunny day, and you could just drive right into the burial ground. It's a beautifully laid out place with a sort of oval design to the main cartways, and it has old trees and lots of, and at that time the vegetation is kind of not as rampant as it is during wet and hot periods. And at the same time, the neighborhood was very scary because of everything I'd heard about it. On subsequent visits, I think as I became more acquainted with the stories and understood what was happening there and saw the active drug market, I think the fear factor increased for me. But that first visit, I was impressed with what a resource it really was, a whole city block there that was basically trees and, at that time, maybe in some parts like 8-foot-high vegetation, but it had the potential of being a serene, green place.
I'm wondering if you and the other Quakers felt an almost personal sense of violation because there were so many drugs getting sold on the site of Lucretia Mott's grave and other graves of people who have been historically very important in the Quaker community.
I think distress was more my my sense in response to that. It's distressing to see people's lives in such disarray and so hopeless and strung out. So that when you see people in that condition, I think distress is what you can feel. The state of the property was very upsetting. And I'm just one of those people that sort of likes to get things back in order. So I think those were the major, like, what do we do about this? How can we make this, fix this up?
Would you tell us a little bit about the Quaker idea of death and burial and the role of a cemetery in the life of the neighborhood that it's in or the lives of the people with family buried there?
Well, Quakers don't see burial grounds as hallowed ground in the same way that many religious groups do. So we're quite comfortable using it for what we think is appropriate. Many of us who grew up as friends experienced being in a friend's school right next to the burial ground and kind of seen it as an extension of our school grounds wandering about there. I mean, you want to treat it respectfully, but we don't see it as that special. And in early times, they didn't even mark the graves. That became a later addition. It was considered somewhat ostentatious. So there's still a sense of, let's use this ground in ways that make sense for a community and respect the people that are buried there and their living relatives who want to pay respects or know that the place where their remains are is well cared for. But it's about the living. I mean, we need to be responsive to that.
Well, you're the president of the group that's trying to restore the cemetery. Why is this project so important to you?
Good question. I think it, both for itself, I really like the place and I like the people that I've gotten to know there. I think it's kind of an experiment, though. It's like, what can people who live in suburban or urban settings but are not in such distressed states do about those that are? How can we respond to these conditions? And what can we learn from this one experiment about what we can do more widely in the city? And I think a lot of the people that come there to work on it are very gratified by that opportunity to do something real and concrete where they can see at the end of a couple of hours of volunteer labor with other people what they've accomplished. I mean, it's concrete. And they can feel that this does really make a difference to the neighborhood. And I think the neighbors are reflect that back to us. We appreciate that you're taking care of your property. We value you as a neighbor. And that's kind of how we've looked at it, as being responsible stewards of property.
What kind of connections have you made with the residents of the community that the cemetery is in and the activists within the community?
Well, the first resident I met was Elizabeth Gutierrez, who lives with her husband, three boys, and a young daughter, right on the south side of the burial ground. And she's a very diminutive person, but just full of fire and determination and I don't know if she's fearless, but she faces a great deal on a daily basis in terms of things that would make most people fearful. She worked with us on the sort of predecessor project where we're looking at what can we do. And she grew up in that neighborhood, so she had visions and memories of how the neighborhood functioned in an earlier time, its communality, how much the burial ground added to the lives of people in just a very passive way. People walk through it, but they just like looking at it. They could open their windows. They could hear birds sing. They could see roses bloom. So that was really kind of inspiring. And Elizabeth's daily struggles and her valiant efforts are very inspiring as well. Subsequently, I met Peaches Ramos, who is a activist in that neighborhood and has been for many years and has accomplished a great deal. I met Hilda Cologne, who works actively with her in the 9th and Indiana Association and lives just on the east side of the burial ground along 9th Street. And Hilda, I initially met on the phone because she'd call and tell me about things that were going on there and urge me to do something about them. So we worked together a lot that way. And then on the northwest corner is the Way to Heaven Ministry, which ministers to recovering addicts, especially those Spanish-speaking ones, from that community but from a much broader area. And the Reverend Rosado and his wife Bonnie do just a wonderful job there. And they have helped us out enormously by providing a sort of litter control around the burial ground, both inside and outside, and being our eyes on the street. So those have been kind of the main anchors in the community, I think, that have been helpful to us.
When the Quakers decided to take back the graveyard and take responsibility for cleaning it up, where did you start cleaning?
Well, there already was a volunteer group that met on regular Saturdays. So we started to concentrate our energies on that those Saturday mornings and kind of space them out, give them some regularity, and concentrate the time during which we cleaned so we'd have a lot of people there. That helped. Pickup was just the first thing we started doing. We took dumpster load after dumpster load out of there of hot water heaters and mattresses and old refrigerators and car fenders. And
people were throwing their old refrigerators into the cemetery?
Well, obviously people don't throw them, so they were backing their trucks in and dumping it off. So that was the other thing that we did immediately. We tried to secure the whole perimeter so truckloads didn't come in. People threw things, too. But, I mean, the main stuff was probably, from my days working in clean city activities, are probably contractors who are looking for a cheap place to dump. And they're not necessarily from that neighborhood. They just look for some place that it doesn't look like anybody's going to do anything to stop them.
So really, the cemetery had become not only a haven for drug dealers, but a junkyard.
Absolutely. And you know, you've probably heard enough about how cleaning and those things work together, that when people see a place that is treated that way, then they feel they can treat it that way, too. So it's cycles.
So the junkier it gets,
yeah,
the
worse it gets.
Feel,
yeah.
Right, like,
and
mm-hmm.
conversely, when you mm-hmm. start to correct that, people start to amend their behavior also.
Well, do you feel that happened? That as
oh,
soon
yeah,
as you
absolutely.
Started hauling the junk
absolutely.
Out of the graveyard,
absolutely.
That
absolutely.
How did it change behavior of people?
Well, people would stop and tell us they appreciated it. There was certainly because we secured the perimeter, that we didn't get the volumes in that we were taking out. So we still got people, things thrown in, dead dogs. I mean, there was a lot of unpleasant stuff, bottles, cans, that kind of stuff. But it diminished in volume. That was probably the first thing. And we always had people who picked up. We started on the Cambria Street side. That somehow, the south side, that somehow felt like the friendlier side to us and kind of worked our way north. And people would comment, people who came, you know, irregularly would say, oh, it looks much better than it did. So we encouraged ourselves in that way.
What were some of the rumors that you heard in the neighborhood before the cemetery was cleaned up about what was really there, what its real history was?
Well, the most persistent rumor is that it's a pet cemetery. And this is persistent and apparently was true a long time ago, even when it was well-maintained. So it's not a question of it's being maintained. I think it's because it has low stones and rather than more elaborate stones. That's the best answer I can give, because when people tell me that, I ask them, gee, what makes you think that? And how did you hear it? And that's the best sense I can make of it.
And what connotation does pet cemetery have?
To the people that are supposing that, I think somehow less important or less religious. And also that it's okay to put your dead dogs in there. So.
Right. That's maybe
that's
why
not
people
a
were
very
tossing
good,
your dead dogs in.
Not a good connotation from our perspective.
My guest is Marianne Hunter. She's the president of the Fairhill Burial Ground Corporation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Marianne Hunter. She's the president of the group leading the effort to clean up a historic Quaker cemetery that was virtually taken over by drug dealers and users. What role would you like the burial ground to play in the future of the community?
Well, I would like it to return to being that place where people can get a sense of serenity and beauty. And whether that's in a passive way by people looking in, I'd rather have us figure out how it can be a more active way so that people can use it for activities that would feel appropriate to them and to us. The work with the kids is wonderful and has been very exciting to our volunteers and our board. And recently, we had someone who was bringing in a group of kids from North Carolina, Friends School, down there, New Garden Friends School, to work. So in preparation, he went around on the Indiana side and talked to the dealers there and said, I'm going to be bringing a bunch of school kids in, and I'm going to bring them through the gap in the fence that's here for a variety of reasons. Will they be okay? And it was really a very striking conversation that he reported to me, how these people engaged in the drug trade were themselves excited to see kids coming there and doing this work and making it beautiful. So, you know, who knows? It may even affect the people who are most beleaguered there.
Do you feel like this project is changing you at all and exposing you to things that you hadn't been exposed to before?
Yes, I certainly never experienced that intensity of drug dealing. We can be there on a Saturday morning and there can be 50 or more of us working in the burial ground, and there'll be an equally large number of people out at 9th and Indiana hawking their wares, you know, just hollering out what they have available and where to get it. And that, to me, is shocking, that that kind of active drug trade can be happening on a city street on a Saturday morning between 10 and 12, undisturbed. Now, it has been disturbed. I mean, there have been periods where it's really been put in abeyance. But I have to say now, it seems to be returning.
The drug trade seems to be returning?
To that area. I don't think it ever went away. It just moved to a different location. But it's moving back into that area now.
When you say that area, do you mean like closer to the cemetery too?
Yeah, the whole 9th and Indiana. I mean, mm-hmm. That's the northern, right. 9th and Indiana is the mm-hmm. northern boundary of the burial ground. And it was that very, very active there. And then March a year ago, you may remember where there was a batch of bad heroin sold, which killed people right away instead of more gradually. Within, I would say, 48 hours, the drug trade was stopped dead there. Now, most of the credit I give to Peaches Ramos, because she had been working for and agitating to get the police mobile unit stationed there during the week, and she succeeded in doing that.
She's a neighborhood activist.
Absolutely. The neighborhood activist, we might even say, although she certainly brings a lot of people along with her. So when that was true, it reduced the drug trade dramatically. But I believe that there must have been other events connected with this bad heroin stuff that also caused that trade to be shut down in that area.
So how discouraging do you find it that the drug trade seems to be returning in spite of your efforts?
Well, I don't think it's in spite of our efforts. I think it's in spite of the neighborhood efforts. I give them the credit for that. I think it's a difficult problem and that we all have to keep working on it. When it was in abeyance, it allowed neighbors on both sides of that street to connect with one another and work actively. They're planting a garden on Hutchinson Street north of Indiana, and really strengthen themselves because they could communicate. They could walk out and know each other across Indiana. And that's the most distressing part of it, that if it really becomes active like that, it may halt their efforts to come together and rejuvenate their neighborhood. That would be my biggest concern. It doesn't affect us as people like it does people in the neighborhood. I mean, just... So our effort is to try to be part of that neighborhood effort and support it as much as we can. So it's distressing. But in the long haul, I'll put my belief in the neighbors. I think they're going to prevail.
Do you know if there are any people who have family buried in the cemetery who still come and visit the grave?
Oh, yes. And there, Jim Glacken on our board has family members buried there. We've had people who just read about it in the paper that we were doing cleanup and who came to help us out because they have family members buried there. I got a call and a letter from someone who's too elderly to visit now, but she sent me some pictures because I said we're trying to resurrect, you know, a visual history of what the burial ground was. And was this woman as a young girl and the caretaker's daughter. And so there are lots of people who feel a real connection to it, either from living in the neighborhood and or having family members buried there.
Are these people who were afraid to come visit before the cleanup?
Yes.
Maybe they wouldn't even.
Many of them still might be. And we don't encourage people to just kind of come by casually. We say, come when we're doing a cleanup or let us know and we'll meet you there. Or, you know, we try to make it more of an event.
Can you estimate how many Members of the community are involved in the cemetery cleanup project.
The local area?
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that among volunteers, there might be maybe 25 people who have helped us off and on. The Julio de Burgos kids regularly come, and oftentimes they bring parents.
It's the middle school kids.
Yes. So that's a good part of that cadre. And then there's a local block captain, and he comes often, and he lives along Indiana, so he keeps an eye from his side. People from Way to Heaven often come, even though they do community service by cleaning up during the week. They sometimes come on Saturdays as well, although that's a busy day for them in the life in their community. So that, I might be underestimating, but I would say in that neighborhood.
The neighborhood that the cemetery is in has been nicknamed the Badlands, largely because of all the drug dealing mm-hmm. that happens in the streets there. What do you think of that nickname?
Oh, the people there hate it. And it doesn't, it reflects that activity. It doesn't reflect the place. Most of the people there are wonderful, solid, law-abiding family people. So we'd like to think that maybe someday the people will think of it as the Fair Hill neighborhood. And I think all of us are working toward that. That might not be the name, but that was a, you know, a historic name.
That's the name of the burial ground, the Fair Hill burial ground.
But it was also a neighborhood name, and it was derived in part from the Isaac Norris's estate was called Fair Hill, so that was like the lands that were there.
The neighborhood that the cemetery is in remains a very poor and a very violent neighborhood, a neighborhood with a lot of drugs blatantly being sold on the street. It's still a dangerous neighborhood to be in. What do you think the odds are that the cemetery will be a kind of safe place where people can go and reflect on Lucretia Mott or the past or just the grass and the trees that are there, just to almost have like a little park space to be in? Do you think it can ever be a safe place for people to visit?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I do. Remember, the people that live in that neighborhood, whom we would expect to enjoy it, live with that those conditions all of the time. So anything that adds to their sense of enjoyment of their life is a benefit. And they are amazingly tough about how they manage their lives and prevail.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Marianne Hunter is the president of the Fair Hill Burial Ground Corporation in Philadelphia. In the second half of our show, we'll hear from a teacher, a student, and a neighborhood activist involved in the cemetery cleanup. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the effort to clean up a Quaker burial ground and reclaim it from the drug dealers who had taken it over. We'll talk to a middle school teacher, one of his students, and a community activist. Also, Milo Miles reviews CDs by a band of Cuban residents and expatriates. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're talking about a Quaker cemetery in North Philadelphia, which in the 1980s became a virtual junkyard and a haven for drug dealers and users. No one in the neighborhood seemed to know that important abolitionists and 19th century reformers, including Lucretia Mott, were buried there. The Quakers have joined with members of the community to reclaim the cemetery as a historic burial ground and as a tranquil place for people living around it. Ron Whitehorn teaches in the neighborhood at the Julia de Burgos Middle School. He's created a student project revolving around the cemetery cleanup effort. He came to our studio with one of his students, 12-year-old Sofia Gonzalez. I asked Whitehorn to describe how the cemetery looks now.
Today, it is, I wouldn't say it's been completely transformed, but it's 75% of the way there. Today, all the brush is gone. The grass is mowed. The walkways, which are made of brick, many of them have been restored. The graves have been cleaned away. The fence has been repaired. There is still some. When we cleaned it up a couple months ago, the kids and myself found about 40 needles. So the problem with the drugs is far from solved. But it looks a lot different. It looks a lot better. It's a different place today.
How close is the cemetery to the middle school?
3 blocks.
Sophia, what did you used to think about the cemetery? Would you walk through it?
No, I don't think I will walk through it because when I went before, I would like walk by with my sister saying from a friend's house, and it's all dirty and has trash and everything, and I wouldn't want to go through it because I see a lot of people coming in and out, and I wouldn't want to go through it.
Were there any superstitions about who was buried there, or you know how there's superstitions about cemeteries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's cats, dogs, and mouses and stuff.
Tell me what the cleanups are like at the cemetery. I think like every one Saturday a month?
No, it's people... quarterly.
It's quarterly.
The cleanups are every season. There's
uh-huh.
one.
So tell me what a typical cleanup day is like.
Well, there are a whole lot of Quakers there from all over the Delaware Valley. Different Quaker meetings, send groups.
Right, this was first a Quaker burial ground, and all the people buried there are friends.
That's right. And the Quakers have kind of taken it, after relinquishing it, have kind of taken it back. And then there's a good number of community people and residents and people from the settlement house in the neighborhood. And then there's our students. That's pretty much the constituencies that are represented there. And It's Mary Ann Hunter who's the driving spirit behind this whole effort. I mean, she's there and she has lists of things to do, and some people are working on sidewalks, and some people are picking up trash, and some people are raking leaves, and it all goes very nicely. And then we usually gather up at the end for some kind of snack and a few words of reflection about what it all means, and that's pretty much it. You planted flowers one time, didn't you? Bulbs, and they came up. Sophia planted some bulbs, and then they came up the following season.
It must have been a good feeling to see the results of your work months after
you
planted them, and flowers are so pretty. You know, you said before that there's a lot of needles that you found in the park. Do you wear gloves or anything when you're cleaning up so that
absolutely.
You don't stick yourself?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does that worry you?
Yeah, sometimes. Like, I make sure, like, I don't... find that, like, if I find something, I'd be sure to call somebody to pick it up because I don't want to pick it up. Probably go to the glove or something.
Ron, why did you make cleaning up the cemetery part of a school project?
Well, our team, we're a team of teachers, and our theme that we try to organize our teaching around is architecture and urban development. And one of my concerns was to really make connections between what we're teaching in the classroom and the lives of our students, and to begin to give the students a better sense of what some of the history of their neighborhood is and some of the resources the neighborhood has. And the burial ground struck me as a good place to start, both because of its historical importance, but also because it's the only piece of undeveloped land in that area. It's the highest point in North Philadelphia. It has a beautiful stand of trees. So I'm a science teacher. So from the standpoint of the trees and the ecosystems there, it also made a lot of sense. And we wanted to build a tree farm there to serve the the neighborhood. So those were some of the reasons why it appealed to us. And I met Marianne Hunter, who's a Quaker and who's been active in trying to organize the Quakers to restore it, and it was a natural kind of partnership.
Yeah, I'm wondering, this used to be a haven for drug dealers, and there's still, you say, drug dealers on one corner. Do they ever watch, Ron, when you're there with your students? That must be pretty eerie sometimes, no?
We try to kind of keep away from them, but they can see we're there, and some of them have, you know, yelled things and that kind of thing. And some of them, I mean, I know some of them. You know, some of them are former students, so I mean, I've had some interaction with them. But for the most part, we try to, because of the potential for some violence, not necessarily from them directed at us, just because there's so many drive-bys and that kind of thing, we try to keep the kids away from that corner.
When you're out there with your students in the cemetery and there are drug dealers on a corner, do you feel that you and the students are respected by the drug dealers, even though they're not going to be participating in something like that? The ones who know who you are and who understand.
I think so. I mean, the ones, the drug dealers that I know and that I've talked to, most of them regret what they're doing at some level. I mean, they may engage in some bravado about it, but they fundamentally, I think, they know this. It's not a good life. I mean, you don't know too many 40-year-old drug dealers that are doing well, and they understand that. And I think most of them who I had as students respect that we were trying to make better lives for the children, and so they respect what we're doing.
The cemetery that you've been helping to clean up connects to the Presidential Summit on Volunteerism earlier in the spring, which is held in Philadelphia. I think that was one of the sites that was cleaned up during the summit. Ron, what was your attitude toward the summit, or all these, you know, big famous people coming in to clean up your neighborhood?
Well, I really think it was a sham. I mean, it makes me angry because the way I see it, I mean, the people who are now out there giving their one day of volunteerism, the corporate America, they're the people who've disinvested North Philadelphia and who have deprived the neighborhood of the resources it needs to be viable. And then to turn around and challenge everyone to come out and volunteer is really obscene to me. I mean, who can be against volunteerism? Of course, it's good that people give of their time to help other people, but it really glosses over what the fundamental question is in relationship to the neighborhood, which is the disinvestment of the neighborhood and all the problems that's left us with.
Sophia, what do you like and what do you not like about your neighborhood?
What do I not like?
And what do you like, both?
The drug dealing, the killing and stuff, and when you sleep, you hear gunshots and stuff. And what I like, I don't know, is parks around, like clean parks. And
there are clean parks?
Yeah. It's a park around my house, and it's clean. It's not, they don't let nobody in, like drug people in there. And that's where I go sometimes. And I don't know. There's a Spanish place for kids. Like, you could go over there, and they have dances and stuff. That's kind of fun for me.
Your neighborhood has been nicknamed the Badlands. What do you think of that name?
I don't like it because they brand us like we bad or something. Like, just because dumb people are selling drugs and those people are shooting people doesn't mean that I'm going to go outside and I'm going to shoot somebody because I'm not bad. I mean, I don't go outside and I hit somebody for looking at me wrong, or they want to take my sneakers or something, and I'm going to hit them or kill them or shoot them or whatever. And they say that everybody in here is bad because we live in Philadelphia, the Badlands. So I'm going to go outside and I'm going to be bad or something.
Because you're spending a lot of time trying to clean up the cemetery, when you see people either throwing trash there or selling drugs there, do you feel particularly resentful of it because you're working so hard to change that part of the neighborhood?
Yeah, I do. I feel that. It really makes me angry generally when I see people throw trash on the ground or throw trash in my classroom or But yeah, given the effort and the people have made, and people have made out of the goodness of their hearts or out of their commitment to the neighborhood, not because anybody paid them or anything like that, to clean it up, and then for someone else to come along and trash it, makes you really angry.
What about you, Sophia? You got angry at that too?
Yeah, because when I went, I seen my bulbs and they were all nice, and came back again and they was all stepped on and everything.
Oh, these are the bulbs that you planted?
Yeah.
Oh, that must have been upsetting.
A lot of trash around them, yeah. Because I spent all my time planting them, digging up the dirt, and to come back to see them all squished.
Ron Weinhorn teaches at the Julio de Burgos Middle School in North Philadelphia. Sophia Gonzalez is one of his students. Coming up, neighborhood activist Peaches Ramos, who lives across the street from the cemetery. This is Fresh Air. Peaches Ramos lives across the street from the Fairhill Burial Ground. She watched this Quaker cemetery get taken over by drug dealers and is now working with the effort to clean it up. Ramos is an activist and block captain in the neighborhood with the city's highest murder rate. Her current efforts include pressuring the police for better protection and organizing a summer day trip for neighborhood children. I asked her to describe her block.
Okay, the block I live on the 3000 block of 9th Street. I've been there for 20 years, and the block has improved because I'm a block captain for 10 years, and we've been fixing it up. There's a program called Model Block, and it's came to our neighborhood, and they have like a grant that we had paid 20%, and we got doors, windows, sidewalks, so the neighborhood looks nice. We got trees, you know, and they don't look as trashy as it used to be. And my neighbors are, like, pulling together now because it looks a little bit better. And I don't have nobody standing on my corners. Like, what I'm referring to is the drug dealers. They're around the corners, but they respect me because I'm not going to let them push me away. A lot of my neighbors, they wanted to leave, but they're staying. They're struggling with me.
Do you want to leave?
I guess not, because I'm used to the neighborhood. They respect me. It's hard because there's so much tragedy going on. But I learned to deal with it, and I just try to take one day at a time. And I think about all the dangers around the trying to raise my kids, but I try to raise them the best way I can. I just pray every night to God to help me go through day by day, and, you know, I figure, I don't know, people ask me, they give me $1 million, would I leave? I always say no. I'll probably take a vacation, but I guess I'm used to the neighborhood.
How did you become a community activist?
Well, I've been there for 20 years, and I got really strong. Like 3 years ago, they had killed a girl for her pair of earrings and another little boy for $5, and it was just like, one killing after the other. That's when I got really strong, because these kids used to be in my house with my kids. And it touched my heart because I figured it can happen to them, it can happen to one of mine. And I learned to deal with these parents and these kids, and that's when I said, that's it. It's time to get rough out here, start a fight. And that's when I started getting more of the community together with me, the neighbors, and that's when we started fighting, because it was just doing too many killings for no reason.
What were you doing to fight back?
Well, we kept on writing to the police. We wrote to Richard Neal. We wrote to the president. We wrote to everybody we could think of, the politician and everybody. We got the mobile station parked on the corner for about 4 or 5 months, and we were just calling the police patrol.
There's a mobile police station?
Mm-hmm. And they helped us a lot. And, you know, that's when I got the community more involved, because they've seen the police there. So they said, well, you know, it's time to fight with you.
What does it mean to be a block captain on your block?
What does it mean? Oh, it means a lot to me, because a lot of people, my neighbor come to me with different problems, like any kind of problems, like if they have rats running in their house, if they don't talk to one of the neighbors. I try to get them talking to each other. As a black cat, then I have meetings. I have cookouts for the kids. I try to work with the kids because some of them might not have their parents around. Maybe they might be locked up. They're on drugs. So it makes me feel good because they come to me and ask me to help them, like, for anything, help them to fix their house or anything. You know, and it makes me feel real good. I do a lot. I even feed them sometimes. My husband used to get mad at me, but I just look at them and I just don't want to go through what a lot of them are going through.
There have been a lot of drug dealers in your neighborhood. I'm wondering if you know a lot of them from when they were children.
Yes, I do know a lot of them, and it bothers me because it's a shame. And it's, they don't have no guidance. I figure they're in the corner because their mother and father is not a good role model, and I think of my own. I try to keep my kids in school, and I, you know, I'm not going to keep them away from talking to the neighborhood kids because they all grew together. But I just try to guide minds the right way, and I just pray to God that my kids don't be in the corner and nothing happens to them. But it's hard because I see these kids, and they grew up with mines, and, you know, to see them sitting in the corner hurts me. But I don't. I guess they don't see nothing different. What they see, that's what they're going to do.
What's your goal with your block? What would you, how would you like to see it look?
My goal with my block would be to wake up one day and don't see nobody in a corner, which I don't see nobody staying on my corner, but they're in the surrounding corners. And I would like, you know, for one day to just get up and walk around. I won't see nobody standing, you know, from 5-4 blocks away from my house. That would be my goal.
Do you feel safe walking around your neighborhood?
In a way, yes. In a way, no. Because I know the people around my neighborhood, but, like, you don't know when somebody's going to argue. You don't know when somebody's going to come shoot. And so the bullets have no name. But I'm safe, you know, because I know everybody. But, you know, you're not really safe because you don't know when somebody's going to come around the corner, drug, buy something, and start arguing.
There have been a couple of shootings in your neighborhood that have made the local news. And one of them was the shooting of a 14-year-old boy. He was actually killed, and this is believed to have been an accident. He and a cousin and a friend, all of the age of about 14, were playing with a gun that apparently they probably didn't know was loaded.
Yes.
And one of them was probably accidentally killed. And in fact, you just came from the funeral just a couple of hours before we started recording this interview. I'm wondering what that funeral was like, knowing that both the victim and the shooter were in the same family. Both of these kids were cousins.
Well, it was hard. I just came from there. And what makes it so hard is that the boy's father, that was his only child. And he just lost his dad the day before he lost his only son. And the one that did it, yes, it was his cousin. And they was real close, and they was playing with the gun. And that's what I try to teach these kids out there. Do not play with guns. I mean, I don't even let my son play with a toy gun. I don't like them in my house. And it's a shame. You know, now, you know, it was a shame. I mean, it was a beautiful ceremony. It was a lot of people that came. But it broke my heart, and it touched my heart because I've been to so many funerals, and I just keep on praying to God that I don't have to go to my kid's funeral because it's a lot of pain, and we don't bury a lot of kids around our community.
Did you bring any of your children to the funeral, or do you want to protect them from being exposed to that?
Well, I brung all of them except one because I have a one-month-old, but I brung them all because, well, except my other, he's in school today, but I, you know, I usually bring them so they can see the tragedy, what goes on, and how hard it is to lose somebody in your family, and what happens when you're doing something you're not supposed to be doing. I usually take my kids. I have 5 kids, and 3 of mine went today with me.
Your neighborhood has been nicknamed the Badlands. What do you think of that name?
We don't like it because back 2 or 3 years ago, I was talking about that. We're not the Badlands. We have decent kids out there, decent parents that are trying to make good And we're not the Badlands. I don't know why they call us the Badlands. We're North Philly, just like Center City. And they gave us the Badlands because there was so much drugs around and so much shooting. And it's a shame that, you know, people like, that's the Badlands. But we're North Philly. And I used to fight with the reporters and tell them, don't put us as the Badlands because this is not the Badlands. No matter what, it's North Philly. And people used to say, oh, you live down the street. That's this and this and that. I have no complaints. You know, it's hard, but you got to struggle the best way you can.
Let me get back to the Quaker burial ground that's down the street from where you live.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the process of getting cleaned up. It's in much better shape than it's been in many years. What would you like to see it become?
Well, maybe like downtown where they got Bessie Ross House, maybe we can get some people to come look at it, walk around. You know, we can see that there's important people there. And something to be, I guess, proud of, because we got important people in our neighborhood and people don't even know who's really burying there. It looks nice, and, you know, that's what I would like to see. Maybe we can get tours to come out here and check the neighborhood out there and maybe help with our community. We can get more help and more attention down here.
Laura, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And good luck with your efforts to clean up the neighborhood.
Thank you.
Peaches Ramos is the block captain on the street just across from the Fairhill Quaker Burial Ground in North Philadelphia. Our interviews about the cemetery were produced by Dorothy Farabee and Roberta Sharrock. Coming up, Cubanismo. This is Fresh Air. Cubanismo is a 16-piece band that includes both expatriates and Cuban residents. The group's two CDs have been popular outside the core Latin audience. Cubanismo recently played several club dates in the United States. Milo Miles attended one of those performances and has this review.
Trumpeter Jesus Alemany has some kind of ear. First, he spends more than a dozen years in Sierra Maestra, the most subtly progressive yet folkloric Cuban band of the 1980s. Then Alemany went out on his own in 1995 and cherry-picked players for a big band he calls Cubanismo. Although the group's debut CD was a hit by world music standards, it sounded a bit tentative to me. But Cubanismo's new album, Malembe, and a performance I saw on May 4th at the Roxy in Boston, provided torrents of music. This is why American audiences flocked to Cuban bands for decades before Castro. Thank you.
urbanismo está pegado. Cógelo si puedes, si puedes, si puedes, si puedes.
Like Sierra Maestra, Cubanismo sounds light, with quick-changing arrangements that nevertheless have lots of sinew and dense little jam sessions. Singer Rojitas is a star in Cuba, and his style is brawny but not overwhelming. He fits in doing rhythm-boosting chants as well as floating over the beats in his featured numbers. Tata Guinness is a masterfully calm conga player who shows how to relax behind hard licks. But the unassuming hero of Cubanismo is pianist Alfredo Rodriguez. He fled the island in 1960, and it seems he listened to lots of Thelonious Monk and Horace Silver during his stay in the United States. But his idiom is his own. Again and again at the Roxy, his solo spots would turn a tune around a dramatic corner of rhythm. And not only that, his solo album, called Cuba Linda, outshines either of the Cubanismo releases. Cuba Linda is that rarest of items, a session where the musicality of percussion instruments glows. The piano is simply the most eloquently tuned beater. The sheer nimble heft of Cubanismo is a crowd pleaser, though. You get rumbas that build from polyrhythmic skeletons to flesh jiggle full band blowouts and back again. And Melembe even features a resplendent slow danzón, Daulena. You want to follow this band's moves because they never run out of new ones. Let this be a preview of Cuban jams after communism.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. Our engineers this week are Bob Prudick, Joyce Lieberman, Fred Snyder, and Chris Fraley. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, interviews with jazz saxophonist James Moody and late-night host Conan O'Brien. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.